Hey, good morning, everybody. About 2:31 lecture, and it's Thursday, July 23rd. And see, this week was big. You had a lecture exam on Tuesday, had a practicum yesterday, Wednesday, and today's Thursday. And we're going to finish up heart and probably move into the vascular system today as well. All right, so that's the schedule for lecture. And I have to point out a couple things regarding the schedule. I noticed last time that the very last day of school, I have Tuesday, August 5th. Well, August 5th is correct, but that is a Wednesday, right? So we got to go to school that last week on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Right? So don't think that you're off on Wednesday. Sorry, I'll send an email out to everybody. Make sure you realize that. And the sign-in sheet says that as well. Okay, so August 5th is a Wednesday, not a Tuesday, and just plan for that. The other thing you have to plan for on Wednesday, August 5th, is that you have a lecture exam on that day covering these chapters, plus also you have the last practicum. So practicum and lecture exam on the same day. Fortunately, you get a little bit of a break between the two, and let's see, you've got two weekends. You got 2 weekends before that happens. So don't waste the weekend coming up, right? Plan for it, and in 2 weeks you'll be done with the class and ready to move on. So that's the payoff, okay? But you'll be done with the class really soon and ready to move on. So lecture exam and practicum on Wednesday, August 5th. Anybody have a question on that? Probably not, okay? And if there's anything I can do to help you guys out, make sure you let me know. Let's see, I want that off, that. Okay. All right, so we were looking at the heart last time. I'm going to put the schedule away. And I said probably one of the more important figures in the cardiac chapter is this one right here, right? Because it tells us a lot about the heart that we want to know, like how many chambers does the heart have? Four. How many valves does the heart have? Right. How many sides does the heart have? Two. And then how many circulations are there? There are two. Right. So that all fits into this illustration nicely, but there is something else. It also defines for you what an artery is, what a vein is, and a capillary. That's really important. We're going to observe that in the next chapter as well. All right. So as far as the chambers, there are two superior. Those are the atria, the right and left atrium, and then below that are the big strong chambers called ventricles, and here is the right and here is the left, and sometimes we just call this the LV for left ventricle. All right, sometimes we just call this the RV for right ventricle. So those are the four chambers. The four valves are broken down into two groups. The first group are valves between an atrium and a ventricle. Those are atrioventricular valves. There's one on the right, one on the left. One on the right is the tricuspid. One on the left is the bicuspid or mitral valve. Those are both AV or atrioventricular valves. And we're going to look at those in lab, the real valves, today when we start doing some dissections. So that means there's two other valves. The other valves are at the base or the root of the great arteries coming off the base of the heart. There are two of them. One is the pulmonary artery or pulmonary trunk, and the second one is the aorta. Right? So neither of those are really called arteries, but they are. You could call this the pulmonary artery. That would be fine with me, but its real name is pulmonary trunk because it splits into the right and left pulmonary arteries pretty quickly. I'll show you that really soon. And then the aorta, nobody ever calls that an artery because they're so familiar and aware that it is an artery that we never name it such. Right? And I see an artery in red, and I see an artery in blue. Is that a mistake in the book? It is not, because how do you define an artery? An artery, it takes blood away from the heart, and it doesn't matter what the state of oxygen is, right? The red represents relatively high oxygen, blue represents relatively low, and in the pulmonary artery, it's relatively low. That makes perfect sense because it's going to the lungs to pick up oxygen. Right, so there would be no sense for this blood to go to the lungs if it was high in oxygen to begin with. Right, so That makes perfect sense. So you got arteries and veins, and then you see this other network right here. These are capillaries. Something special happens in a capillary. What is that special thing that can only happen in a capillary? And that is exchange, right? Not just exchange of gases, but exchange of nutrients and waste products. That's how things, hormones, other kinds of compounds can enter or leave a blood vessel only in a capillary. If there's a compound in an artery or a vein, it is stuck there, can't get out, because we're going to see in the next chapter why, but the walls are way too thick to allow for exchange. All right, so those are some important things. The last thing, maybe I have it here. All right, where do I have it? Ah, here's a really good figure, right? It shows all three landmarks to get you started with the heart. Remember I said there's three things that you have to know. They're really easy to observe. But once you see these three really easy things, everything in the heart sort of falls into place, right? And what was the first thing I mentioned? The apex of the heart, number one. Number two, the base of the heart. And then number three, that anterior longitudinal sulcus, right on the anterior side of the heart. And if you know those three things, then you know the left side, the right side, the superior, inferior, right, then you really are on your way. As long as you know there are two atria on top, two ventricles on the bottom. Okay, so that's pretty much a quick review. I don't want to go over layers, but if you have questions about layers, we should go over them once again. Oh, here are a couple of terms that I did not use last time. Systole and diastole. So these are very important. Here we have the heart. Let me go back to that first illustration, so it's so important. So here we have a heart. There are actually two pumps, right? A ventricle pressurizes this fluid, and a fluid will move from high pressure to low. So ventricles have the highest pressure, atria have the lowest, so blood is going to flow through the circulation from a ventricle back to an atrium, right? So think of maybe pressure as being like the concentration of a compound when you think of diffusion, right? So pressure is the motive force for moving this fluid, whether it's a gas or a liquid, it doesn't matter. In this case, it's a liquid. All right, well, these pumps, right, the right and left side of the heart, these pumps are not always pumping blood. We have a lot of pumps around our house and our car that will be pumping all the time. Electric pumps will just be continuously pumping, pressurizing the fluid inside of them, but not so for the heart. The heart is what we call a reciprocating pump. Sometimes it is pumping, sometimes it is relaxing, right? And so the heart has different phases. It has two phases. One phase of the heart is when the muscle is contracting and it's pressurizing blood, it's pumping blood out. The other phase of the heart is when the muscle relaxes, right? And it doesn't pump when the heart is relaxing, but something special is taking place. When the heart relaxes and it's not pumping blood, that allows blood to enter the ventricles. That's so important, because if it goes back into the contraction phase and there's no blood in the ventricle, then the heart can contract, but it won't pump any blood, and that won't help anybody, right? So there are two important phases of the heart cycle. When it's pumping, that's called systole, right? And when it's relaxing, we call that diastole. Diastole is relaxation and systole. So you should probably know, what is a good description of systole and what is happening? What's happening during systole? Okay, the heart muscles, the myocardium is contracting, and when these muscles contract, it pumps blood. So systole is when blood is being pumped and the muscle is contracting. Diastole is when the muscle relaxes. When the muscle relaxes, it can't pump, but it allows the pump to fill with blood so that during the next systole, it can actually pump something, can pump that blood. All right, so here we have systole and diastole in the slide, and that's really important to know. All right, we didn't talk about the fibrous skeleton, but we're going to come back to that in a second, because I want to jump over to the conduction system of the heart. All right, so can you remember what are the three kinds of muscles, generally speaking? What are three important kinds of muscles in your body? Skeletal, I like that. Smooth and cardiac. Okay, skeletal muscle we're familiar with. You'd have to know a whole bunch of them. They're under voluntary control. Call it skeletal muscle because they're connected to your skeleton. They move your skeleton around. Voluntary muscle. Now, what about the heart? Is it voluntary or involuntary? Involuntary. That's right. You cannot cause your heart to stop or to speed up. All right. Maybe with some meditation techniques, you can influence the rate of the heart, but pretty much not the force of contraction ever. So the heart pretty much takes care of itself. It has some intrinsic properties, but it's also regulated by the autonomic nervous system. It has parasympathetic and sympathetic nerve fibers going to it. Right, so it's a very important organ. It is dually innervated. Parasympathetic nervous system slows the heart down. Sympathetic speeds the heart rate up. Right, so just like the gas pedal and brake pedal in your car, it's really good to have both. All right, so how does the heart know when to contract? Well, it listens for those parasympathetic and sympathetic signals, and the parts of the heart that can adjust the force and rate of contraction are what we call the conduction system of the heart. All right, so I want to find conduction system of the heart. I don't know why it's popping up over there. Let's get it over here. All right, so here is almost like a coronal section of the heart. All right, we see the two atria on top, the two ventricles on the bottom. And this atrium right over here, is this the right or the left atrium? It's the right. So this heart right here would be as if you're looking at my heart. All right, so you're looking at my chest, and I'm raising my hand. And what hand am I raising? My right hand, right? So over here is going to be the right side of my heart. Over here is the left side. So here is the right side of the heart. Here is a special kind of muscle cell. It's called the sinoatrial node. There's a group of cells right here. They're not responsible for contracting like most muscle cells, but these are responsible for developing electrical signals that control the rate of the heart. So sometimes the SA node or sinoatrial node is what we call the pacemaker of the heart. And that is right where the superior vena cava enters the right atrium. That is where it's located. So this is the pacemaker, controls the rate of the heart. These electrical signals then flow over all of these muscle cells in atria, and those electrical impulses cause the muscle cells to contract. So those electrical impulses are very fast, and basically that causes both atria to contract together because the electrical signals travel very, very fast. All right, those electrical signals can't get into the ventricles because there is some connective tissue between both atria and both ventricles, and connective tissue cannot transmit electrical impulses, not like nerves and muscles can. And so this electrical signal is trapped within the atria except for one little location. And here it is. It's still in the right atrium. All right. It is called the atrioventricular node, AV node. And it is exactly what it is. It's right on the border between an atrium and a ventricle. And it accepts that electrical signal of excitation from the SA node, holds onto it for a short period of time, and then transmits it right through the connective tissue via this atrioventricular bundle. Here's an atrioventricular bundle. And that takes that electrical signal into the ventricles, and eventually that electrical signal then can excite the ventricles to contract. All right, so the bottom line there is that the atria receive that electrical signal first, and so they contract before the ventricles do. Both atria contract together, right, and then at a later time, both ventricles contract together. Because the job of the atria is to help fill the ventricles with blood. And if the ventricles were contracting at the same time as the atria, then the atria wouldn't have any function because they're so weak. Right? So first the atria, then the ventricles. And it's this conduction system that, number one, sets up the heart rate, or the rate of the heart, and then number two, delays that signal so that the atria contract first, and then number three, distributes that electrical signal to all of the muscle fibers of the ventricles so that they can contract. All right, so the AV node delays the signal. Then it passes the signal through that connective tissue between atria and ventricles via the atrioventricular bundle. And then it comes down to this region right here. Oh, what do we call this part of the heart, the separation between the right and left ventricle? What do we call this thing, this wall? Yeah, that's the septum, right? Interventricular septum or ventricular septum. So these pathways then diverge into bundle branches. And in the AV bundle right here and the bundle branches, the electrical signal is speeded up to normal speed. It travels very fast, right? But this AV node slows the signal down. Not so for the AV bundle and the bundle branches. And then the electrical signal is diverted into these branches here and here. We call these Purkinje fibers. Purkinje fibers are directly responsible for spreading that electrical signal of excitation out to all of the muscle cells within the heart. Okay, and then the ventricles contract. So what's important to know is that both atria contract together, followed by the contraction of both ventricles. Okay, and there's just a little bit, physiology will learn, that the basal regions of the ventricles contract a little, actually the signals speeds up all the way down through the septum to the apex, and the apical regions of the ventricles then contract a little bit before these basal regions of the ventricles, and that makes really good sense because if the basal regions were to contract first, it would force blood down into the apex, and then once blood was in the apex of the heart, where could it go? It would be trapped. It couldn't go anywhere, right? So one nice thing about the heart, the apex contracts first, forces blood up toward the base then contracts and pushes blood into the great arteries coming off the base of the heart. So there is some coordination, and in physiology we'll look at that coordination. That signal is called the electrocardiogram. Maybe you've heard of electrocardiogram. So all of these specialized cells that I see in yellow or gold right here, these are what we call conducting cells of the heart. They're muscle cells, but here it's a strange muscle cell because they're not specialized to contract. They're specialized to transmit that electrical impulse. It's almost like a nerve impulse. The same kinds of proteins and molecules are involved in these in the membranes of these cells as in nerve cells. All right, so the pattern of conduction is very specific. And one thing that we looked at in histology for the heart was we saw that these muscles are striated, but we also noticed that there was another difference between them and skeletal muscle. Let me see if I can find, oh, here's a pretty good slide. Okay, come on over here. All right, so here is a nice electron micrograph. It's just a nice, simple, light microscope picture of a heart. And I see striations, right? So I know it's either skeletal muscle or that it's cardiac muscle. And I can observe pretty easily that this is cardiac muscle. And who can recall why? Can anybody tell why this is cardiac muscle? It has striations. Ah, but so does skeletal muscle. What else, though, that makes it different than skeletal muscle? Okay, also, you guys are probably saying really good things, but I can't quite hear you. Somebody speak up really loud. What's one thing you notice that makes this different than skeletal muscle? Oh yeah, look at these intercalated discs right here. So myocardial cells are short, right? Skeletal muscle cells are very long. They don't have to join together from end to end, but these myocardial cells do. They have intercalated discs because when this cell contracts, right, and this one over here, its neighbor on the left contracts, they would pull apart, but these intercalated discs have special proteins in the membrane called adherence junctions that glue these cells together so that they don't pull apart. Right, that's important because we don't want any holes in our heart. So that's one thing about these intercalated discs. The other component of this intercalated disc is that there is a pore or a channel between these two individual cells. These are called gap junctions, and this gap junction allows an electrical signal to travel from one cell to the next, to the next, to the next. So if one cell is excited into contract, that electrical signal moves, right, all the way across and will excite all of those muscle cells to contract at basically the same time, right? And that's why the heart contracts as a unit, and that's very important, right? I also see that these cells are branched. So once one cell, like this one right here, is told to contract with an electrical signal, not only are the cells from right to left stimulated into to contract, but also the cells above it and below it. Across the whole wall, all of the cells are excited. That's why these myocardial cells are branched. Okay, so if we stimulate one cell, the whole heart contracts. That would not work for skeletal muscle very well, right? Skeletal muscle does not have gap junctions because, consider this, if I were to reach out and get a cup of coffee and if all my muscle cells had gap junctions between them and I reached out to grab a cup of coffee, what would happen to all the skeletal muscles in my body? They would contract. They would be stimulated into contracting. So instead of getting a cup of coffee, my whole body would just go into spasm. Right? So that doesn't work, but for the heart, that's exactly what you need. And that contraction needs to be coordinated by that conduction system. If there is abnormality in that conduction system or damage to these myocardial cells, then it is possible for other cells to become pacemakers in the heart, and then electrical signals can run around in just random patterns around the heart. And when that electrical signal runs around in random patterns in the heart, then it causes just a random pattern of contraction in the ventricles. And that's what we call fibrillation. Right? Fibrillation is when there's no coordinated contraction, right? Because the synchronization of those excitation of muscle cells is lost, and the muscles are contracting. So maybe just look at my hands. Right? So the ventricles are contracting, but they're not going like this, pumping, pump, pump, pump. They're all contracting, but they're kind of quivering like this. When one side of the heart contracts, the other relaxes, right? And when the heart is quivering like that, it's using up energy, but it's not pumping blood. So no blood is going to the brain. There's really no blood going to the heart because it's not pumping through the coronary circulation, but it's using up valuable energy in the form of ATP. So it's a very dangerous situation. Okay. And the best way to treat that, right, at least for us, if there is an automatic device around, is with a defibrillator. Right? A defibrillator will introduce a shock through the chest into the heart and will cause the whole heart to contract at one time. It will stop that random contraction. The whole heart will contract at one time. And then the hope is that the natural pacemaker of the heart will regain control of that coordinated activity, and then the heart will go back into what we call a normal sinus rhythm after that. Okay? So not always does that happen, but it happens a lot. It's a very useful technique. So that's the purpose of defibrillation, because when a heart is fibrillating, it's using up energy, but it's not pumping blood, so it can't regenerate that ATP. Plus, there's no blood going to the brain. And how long, when the heart starts to fibrillate, do you have consciousness for when your heart begins fibrillating? Because your brain isn't getting oxygen. It needs oxygen to make ATP. How long do you have before you lose consciousness? Yeah, about 2 seconds. 2 seconds, your brain runs out of ATP to maintain consciousness. And then if oxygen supply to the brain is not restored, okay, then your brain uses up all the ATP and it dies. When does your brain die? How long does it take after the heart stops beating? 2 minutes. 2 seconds, you lose consciousness. 2 minutes, the brain dies. And once the brain is dead, what does that mean? Can't come back to life, right? If you lose consciousness, the brain is not dead, so you can bring the person back to life, so to speak, get them back conscious again, but not once the brain dies. Okay. So that's very important. So be aware of these gap junctions within the intercalated discs. Understand how the heart is controlled via those different structures in the conduction system of the heart, like the SA node, AV node. Okay, a couple other things I want to mention about innervation of the heart. We mentioned that there are two divisions of the autonomic nervous system going to the heart, right? Parasympathetic and sympathetic. Parasympathetic, mostly from the vagus nerve. You remember that to be cranial nerve number one. And the parasympathetic innervation can adjust the heart rate. And it does that by changing the activity of the SA node. When something can change the activity of the SA node or the natural rhythm of the SA node, we say that it has a chronotropic effect on the heart. It can adjust the heart rate, right? A chronograph is a timepiece, like a watch that you have on your wrist. And the parasympathetic nervous system can affect the SA node and the AV node. The other division of the autonomic nervous system is the sympathetic. And the sympathetic nervous system goes to the SA node and AV node. Both can adjust the heart rate. In this particular case, sympathetic stimulation increases heart rate. Remember, parasympathetic is the opposite. It slows the heart rate down. But sympathetic nerves also go to the ventricles, and it can increase the force of contraction. And when something can adjust the force of contraction, that's not a chronotropic effect. It's not an effect on the rate of the heart, but it's the force of contraction. We call that an inotropic effect on the heart. And anything that can stimulate the heart to contract stronger, we say it has a positive inotropic effect. If there's a compound that reduces force of contraction, it has a negative inotropic effect. If there's a compound that can speed the heart rate up, that's a positive chronotropic effect. If there's a compound that reduces heart rate, then that is a negative chronotropic effect. So we use chronotropy and inotropy to talk about how the heart is regulated quite a bit. All right, well, the last thing I think I have to mention is this fibrous skeleton. All right, and that fibrous skeleton is that, Okay, I'll go back and get it. Okay, let's go maybe, I don't want to put that one away. So let me put here, go here. And cardiac chapter, where's cardiac? Right here. Nope. I want to look at the pictures. Cardiac right down over here. Okay, we're back. Okay, so we can view the heart. Let's view this illustration right here. All right, so here we have the two atria superiorly, the two ventricles inferiorly. These muscles have gap junctions between them, but there are no muscles in this plane that separates the atria from the ventricle, so electrical signals can't get across this space because there's connective tissue. It's called the fibrous skeleton. So not only does that isolate electrically the atria from the ventricles, which then makes sure that the atria contract before the ventricles, that was important, right? But that also does something else that's very interesting. It helps anchor these valves into the correct position inside of the heart. Let me move this over here, like that, and go back to this word slide. Okay, where's fibrous skeleton? Here's fibrous skeleton. All right, so let's look at this plane right between the atria and the ventricles, and we're going to see that. We're going to see that right here. Okay, so here's the apex, here's the base. So this plane, you will notice, is doubly angulated because your heart has that double angulation, but we want to stay right in the plane of all of these valves. And remember, how many valves were there once again? Four. You see four valves right here? Indeed I do. I see two atrioventricular valves, two semilunar valves. Right, the atrioventricular valves, the one that has three cusps is called the tricuspid on the right side of the heart. There is one that has two, that's called the bicuspid or mitral valve, that's on the left side of the heart. Right, the other kind of valves that are a lot different but they're still there are semilunar valves. Here is the valve at the base of the pulmonary trunk Here is the valve at the base of the aorta. So I would ask you, what valve is the most anterior one on the heart? Which one is the most anterior? I'm going to ask you this probably about 20 times or 50 times before the class is over. So, because you just got to know, especially when we start doing dissections. What's the most anterior? Where's the anterior side of the heart? Where should I move my cursor? Right, left, up, or down? Which way should I move my cursor to go anterior? Down, like that. Aha, here's anterior. Which is the most anterior one? It's a semilunar, and it's a pulmonary semilunar valve. So the pulmonary trunk or pulmonary artery is the most anterior artery coming off the base of the heart. And then what is the artery that is posterior to the pulmonary trunk? It is the aorta, right? Because here's the aortic valve. And then posterior to that are the two atrioventricular valves. Okay, so here, this red tissue right here represents the fibrous skeleton. Here I see some fibrous skeleton, connective tissue. Actually, it lies in this whole plane. And so the job of that fibrous skeleton is to electrically isolate, right, the atria from the ventricles so that they can be, the contraction can be controlled independently, okay, or at least in a coordinated fashion. That fibrous skeleton also is really tough, right, and it acts as an anchor point for these valves so that they can't move around within this plane of the heart. They're anchored into position. The other thing that it does for these valves is that it doesn't allow it to expand. It doesn't allow these valves to dilate, because if they were to dilate, then they wouldn't act like a valve. There would just be a big hole right here between the leaflets. And then blood could squirt back and forth between a ventricle and an atria both ways, and that would eventually kill the heart. Okay, and of course the person. All right, so the fibrous skeleton is really important. It anchors the valve cusps in position. It prevents overdilation of the valve openings, right, so that the valves actually can act like valves. And it acts as an insertion point for the atrial and ventricular muscle, right? Muscles have to have an insertion point so that they can produce motion. And the fibrous skeleton then also blocks the direct spread of electrical impulses from atria into the ventricles. And remember, the only way electrical signals should get from the atria into the ventricles is via the AV node and then the AV bundle. That is the way. Okay. Okay, let's just review a little bit. Where do we find the SA node? Where do we find the SA node? Where is the position of the SA node? Okay, the SA node. Anybody remember taking a look at that SA node? Where was it at? SA node. Right where the superior vena cava enters the right atrium. And I'm looking right at it, but I can't see it. Here. All right, so here is the SA node. Okay, these signals can flow through the muscle cells of the atria because they have gap junctions. That electrical signals get to the AV node. AV node slows the conduction of that nerve impulse. Right, and then it gives up that electrical impulse to the AV bundle, which takes it through the fibrous skeleton. And then that electrical impulse is shared between the bundle branches and then finally distributed to the Purkinje fibers, which causes the muscle cells to contract. Okay. So if somebody has a heart attack and the part of the heart that is damaged is up by the base over here to where the AV bundle is destroyed, right, it dies, and maybe the AV bundle and the AV node is destroyed, then there is no way for the electrical signals from the atria to enter the ventricles. Now, what can happen under those circumstances? Well, the pacemaker, the normal pacemaker of the heart, will still control the contraction of the atria, right? The ventricles will still contract because all cells of the heart can act like a pacemaker. They will spontaneously and rhythmically generate electrical impulses, and then there will be a second pacemaker that develops in some other part of the heart like the ventricles. And in that case, the atria will contract at one heart rate and the ventricles will contract at another heart rate, two different heart rates, and they won't be controlled. Typically, that's not too bad of a situation, because remember, what did we say about the force of contraction of these atria? Is it as strong as the ventricles? It's very weak. So the atria are hardly doing any job for us at all. So if there's no coordination between atria and ventricles, it's really not such a big deal, because the most important thing is the contraction of the ventricles. Right. But it is possible to have fibrillation of the atria without fibrillation of the ventricles, right? Fibrillation of the ventricles is like almost immediately fatal, right? Within a couple minutes. When the atria fibrillate, it can be dangerous. Not so dangerous, because the ventricles will still be pumping blood to the brain, right? But what happens then when the atria fibrillate but not the ventricles, then the atria stop pumping blood, and blood has kind of a funny property. Whenever it stops flowing, it likes to turn into a solid. We call that coagulation, right? And so when blood clots, when the atria aren't pumping blood because they're fibrillating, it can generate blood clots, right, which can go into the ventricles and then get pumped to other parts of the body, like the heart itself or the brain. So if it goes to the heart, that causes a heart attack. If it goes to the brain, that causes a brain attack, which is what we call a stroke. Right? If a blood clot goes to the lungs, we call that a pulmonary embolism. And many times, maybe more times than not, that is fatal as well. Right? So it's important to control these atria so that they don't go into fibrillation. It's not necessary to preserve the function of the heart, but to make sure that the atria don't generate blood clots. That's the important thing, all right, about atrial fibrillation. All right, let's take a look at that exam figure and also the quiz that's going to be coming up, that really nice coronal section of the heart. We're going to look at some final details of the heart. Here it is right here. So it's important to know all of these different items on the heart. And actually, I modified this illustration to include a couple things that are not on this diagram, but you should draw in. All right, let's start with the layers of the heart first. Well, no, I didn't. I tell you what, let's start with what I told you always to start with, okay? That's the best thing to do. What should you always start with? What should you find first? It's not labeled on here, but you should know what it is. It is the pointy end that we call the apex. The second thing you should find is the widest part of the heart, which is the base. And then the third thing, which we can't see unfortunately, is what? The anterior longitudinal sulcus. But that's going to be on the anterior side of it. I can see it over here. We look at the left-hand slide. Right here's a little illustration of it. So if you find those three things, that's really nice, because you know everything about the heart. The two atria, right atrium, left atrium. The two ventricles, right ventricle, left ventricle. Here's that interventricular septum. And if we look at the ventricles, let's look at the free wall of the ventricles. Here's the free wall of the right ventricle. Here's the free wall of the left. And do they look the same? Or do they look different? This part here and this part over here, do they look the same? They kind of look bumpy, but what's the difference between them? One is thinner. Which one is thinner? The right ventricle is a lot thinner compared to the left. That means that the left is stronger because it has more muscle, which also means that the right is weaker because it doesn't have as much muscle. And that's a really nice clue in lab. When we look at a real heart, we're going to observe that. Right? The left ventricle is going to be very big and strong. The right is going to be thin and weak. And the reason why that is because it doesn't, the pulmonary circulation, right, here's the pulmonary trunk bifurcating to the pulmonary arteries, taking blood to the lungs. That's a short circulation. It's not very extensive. It doesn't take as much pressure to get blood to flow through your lungs as compared to the pressure that is required to push blood through your whole systemic circulation. All right, so the pulmonary circulation is low pressure because it's short. Systemic circulation is high pressure because it's a longer circuit, it's a longer circulation, and so the different sides of the heart, right, produce different pressures as a result of that. All right, so if you have a muscle that's working all the time, it's strong. All right, if you have a muscle that's not working quite so hard, it gets weaker. Same thing for the sides of the heart. So this is a nice check. All right, so here we have those ventricles, And we see that there are some muscles within the ventricles that sort of make like a little trabeculae right here. Almost reminds me of spongy bone. See all these little muscles here, here, and here? These are called trabeculae carnei. They help give some structure to the wall, help pressurize blood. So trabeculae I find in the left ventricle and the right ventricle. I see some trabeculae in the atria. But these we don't call trabeculae carnei, we call these pectinate muscles. So we got little pectinate muscles in the atria, stronger ones called trabeculae in both ventricles. And I see another kind of muscle in a ventricle that an atrium doesn't have, and it looks like a fingertip. I see one here, here, I see one here and here. These are what we call papillary muscles. All right, so remember a fingertip in anatomy, we usually call that a papillae, right? Like the dermal papillae where little fingertips of dermis poking up into the epidermis. So these are special muscles because they are attached to the valve leaflets of these atrioventricular valves. So here's the tricuspid, here's the bicuspid. Remember, tri before you buy. And here is the connection between the leaflets and a papillary muscle. They're called chordae tendineae. Chordae tendineae, these are little tendons that attach the valve leaflets to these papillary muscles. So that when the ventricles contract, this valve leaflet just doesn't invert all the way back up into the atria, because if it were to flop back up over here, then it wouldn't act like a valve. And blood would just swoosh back and forth, and that would kill the person, right? Okay, so papillary muscles, you can always identify a papillary muscle because it has to have another structure associated with it. The way to tell it from trabeculae is what? What does a papillary muscle have that a trabeculae carnei does not have? Look at these little heart strings. Papillary muscle always has these heart strings, right? But in our course, these heart strings we want to call chordae tendineae. Both ventricles have them, right? And what ventricle do you think the papillary muscles are larger in? The left or the right? They're going to be a lot larger in the left, right? Because it's a much higher pressure system. Here we see a semilunar valve between the right ventricle and the pulmonary trunk. These don't have papillary muscles. These don't have chordae tendineae on them. It's just the structure of these valves by themselves, right, prevent them from inverting. We'll look at these. We'll see how they inflate really nice in lab. So here's one at the base of the pulmonary trunk. Here's one at the base of the aorta. Okay, so here are two arteries taking blood away from the heart. The veins, oh, look at this. On this illustration, this is nice. I didn't show you this before for some reason. All right, so here's the aorta. It's an artery taking blood away from the heart. It's red, meaning it is oxygenated, which then tells you this is part of the systemic circulation. This part coming away from the aortic semilunar valve from here to here, this is what we call the ascending aorta. And then we have the arch of the aorta, right, the 180-degree bend, and then the descending aorta I can't see because it's behind the heart, but look what's peeking out over here. Guess where I have the cursor right now? Here's the aorta, but it's a descending part of the aorta, right? It's a descending division. So here is the ascending, here's the arch, and then here is the descending. That goes all the way down close to your pelvic cavity. All right, so those are the arteries. The trunk bifurcates into the left and right pulmonary artery. This is going to take blood to the lungs, and of course it's blue because it's deoxygenated. It's going to the lungs to pick up oxygen. And the other blue vessels that we have are attached to the right atria. These are what we call the superior and inferior vena cava. These are huge, big veins returning blood from the systemic circulation into the right atrium, which then is going to get pumped into the pulmonary circulation. Okay? So the superior vena cava returns blood to the right atrium from all the levels of your body above the heart. The inferior vena cava returns blood to the right atrium from all parts of your body that is below the level of your heart. And these two are really big. Okay, the other veins that I see two over here and two over here. I see the ones on the left attaching to the left atrium. And so are the ones on the right. These are colored red, even though they're veins, because what organ are they returning blood from? They're returning blood to the heart, so they're a vein. But what organ are they coming from, since they're red? What organ changes blue blood into red blood? Or another way of saying that, what organ changes deoxygenated blood into oxygenated blood? That's a better way of saying it. And it is the lungs, right? Okay. So these pulmonary veins are the last part of the pulmonary circulation. And don't forget that is shorter. Okay, what's not labeled on this slide? Oh, there's a couple things I got to talk about yet. Okay, but what's not labeled on this slide, on the arch of the aorta, you do have to know the names of these three blood vessels. And this is kind of funny because here we lose some symmetry in the body, right? So three, no matter how you break three, it's not going to be an even number. This first one is called the brachiocephalic artery. And there's only one, so we don't have to say right or left because there's only one. Brachiocephalic, brachio, what do you know about brachio or brachium? Where have you run into that before? Yeah, that's your arm, right? So here's a blood vessel that's taking blood to your arm. The cephalic part of brachiocephalic means your head. It's also taking blood to your head. So brachiocephalic takes blood to your right arm and right side of your head. The next two blood vessels do the same job as the brachiocephalic, but they're separated into two. The one right smack in the middle takes blood to the head. This is what we call a common carotid artery. Common carotid, and it goes to the left side of the head. So here's the left common carotid. Here's an artery that takes blood to the left arm. This is what we call subclavian because we're going to see it go underneath the clavicle, and it's on the left side, so here is the left subclavian artery. All right, so you got brachiocephalic, left common carotid, left subclavian. And you're going to have to know that in the next chapter, and all these chapters are on the same test, so it's good that you become a little bit familiar with it right now. All right, here is a depression in the interatrial septum, right? A fossa is a depression, and guess what the shape of this depression is? The name of this depression is the fossa ovalis. Guess what the shape is? It's oval-shaped, right? That's part of the name. Okay, it's a depression, and it's between both atria, and it's a little residual structure from when we were a fetus. When we're a fetus, there's actually a foramen between the two atria. And in lab, I'll discuss why that hole is in the heart when we're a fetus. Right? But when we're born, that hole should close over so that the right and left side of the heart become independent. Right? If there's a hole right here, blood won't move into the lungs to become oxygenated. It could just get pumped into the systemic circulation. Okay? And that would be a bad thing. All right, here's a depression, fossa ovalis. The last thing on this particular picture are the layers, right? And just like on a bone, remember around the bone was the periosteum, on the inside was the endosteum, and in the middle we had what, compact bone or spongy bone, something like that. So the heart pretty much has that same kind of architecture. On the outside, there's a very thin membrane right on the surface of the heart. We call that the epicardium, okay? Then the heart muscle itself, the layer of heart muscle is called the myocardium. And then there's another thin membrane on the inside of the heart called the endocardium. And the endocardium is very special, right? Because blood is flowing through the heart, and the heart is pretty rough on blood because it contracts very vigorously. These valves are flopping back and forth. Okay? And any kind of mistreatment of blood, it has a tendency to clot. And we don't want to have clots in our blood. So the endocardium is very continuous and smooth, right? It doesn't have any jagged, ragged edges. It's smooth, and in lab you're going to see it's slippery. Smooth and slippery, so blood flows right over the internal structures of the heart. And when we look at the valves, all four of these valves have no muscles in them. They just work passively, and they're also made from endocardium, which means that they are also smooth and slippery. But that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to stay that way through the whole person's life. These valves can be damaged by infection, improper diet. There can be calcium plaques that develop or cholesterol plaques, which are rough surfaces which can generate blood clots. which again can go to the brain, can go to the lungs, right? Can go to your heart. Okay, so that's another reason to have proper diet, just to maintain the health of the endocardium, which maintains the health of these valves right here. Okay, that's it for the heart. Who has a question about the heart? Let's look at some of these main categories once again. Conduction system, right? Got to know the pieces of the conduction system, how those electrical signals flow, fibrous skeleton, the coronary circulation, blood flow through the heart. We drew that on the board. Maybe we'll do that again in lab. Layers, which we just talked about, across the wall of the heart. Instead of saying across the wall of the heart, we could say transmural layers. Transmural just means from outside of a layer all the way through to the inside of some kind of structure. Transmural, across the wall of the heart, or across the wall of a blood vessel, across the wall of tube of your digestive tract. All right, then here are all the pieces of the heart. All right, so I think we did a pretty good job of everything right here. Even talked about fibrillation, innervation, inotropic versus chronotropic effects. Inotropy has to do with force of contraction. Chronotropy has to do with rate of contraction, heart rate. Two independent things. All right. Anybody have a question?
Yes.
The valves prevent retrograde flow, prevent backward flow of blood. Okay, and so let's take a look at the slide. Fortunately, I have right here. Okay, so blood flow through the heart. Blood should enter the heart via an atrium. Then it should flow into a ventricle, and then from a ventricle into an artery. And I'm looking at the right side of the heart, so blood should flow into the right atrium, right ventricle, and then into the pulmonary trunk. It should not go backwards, right? And so here is an atrial ventricular valve that makes sure that blood does not go from a right ventricle backward into the right atrium, right? So when the right ventricle contracts, the tricuspid valve closes. That makes sure that valve goes in, that blood goes into the pulmonary trunk, not backwards. And then when the heart relaxes, the semilunar valve closes so that blood from the pulmonary trunk doesn't flow back into the heart. So these valves maintain blood flow in the proper direction. Okay? The forward or antegrade direction is atria, ventricle, artery, and not the reverse. That's the function of those valves. Okay? So that's pretty important. You ever go outside and maybe walk or take a hike sometime? And maybe you were on a sand dune someplace, a kind of like a mound of sand or a hill of sand, and you say, oh, let's go up to the top of the sand dune. Let's take a look around from up there. And you start walking up a sand dune. Anybody do that? And can anybody tell me, what is it like trying to walk up a sand dune as compared to these stairs right here? All right, these stairs, you step on a stair and you can lift yourself up. Then you step on the next one and lift yourself up. But if you're walking up a sand dune, what happens? Yeah, you take a step up, put your weight on that foot, and what happens? You slide backwards, right? And then you take another step up, put your foot on that piece of the sand dune, and what happens? You slide backwards. Not all the way, but almost all the way. So what is harder, walking up a sand dunes or walking up a stairway? Sand dunes, right? It's like 10 times as hard. It's just amazing how hard it is because you can hardly make any progress, right? So if these valves are not working inside your heart, if they're letting blood flow backwards, that would be like you trying to walk up or run up a sand dunes. It's very hard. But not just for 5 minutes, it's for what? Minute after minute, day after day, month after month, year after year, you trying to walk up those sand dunes. And what would happen to you if I told you for the rest of your life you have to walk up a sand dunes constantly? Well, you'd die. Same thing for the heart, right? It just won't be able to function. And if there are leaks in these valves, right, then they have to be repaired. Or maybe the valve has to be replaced, right? Because it's just too much work on the heart. It's going to cause heart failure. Okay, if you haven't walked up a sand dunes, find some and try walking up. And if you can do that, try running up, right? And you'll be impressed how hard that is. It's just too hard. Okay, so forward flow of blood is so important, that's maintained by
these valves when they're healthy. We call that a competent valve. When a valve is healthy, doing its job, it's competent. If it's letting blood flow backwards, that's what we call an incompetent valve, and that eventually will kill the heart if there's an incompetent valve. Good question. Really important question. Because if your heart is incompetent, then the patient has to make a decision. It's kind of a tough decision sometimes. Right? If you need to replace this valve, how are you going to replace it? You want to replace it with a human cadaver valve? You want to replace it with a pig valve? Or you want a prosthetic valve made out of plastic and metal? They all have advantages and disadvantages. Right? So if you have a real tissue valve, then you don't have to worry so much about blood clots. But you might have to worry about rejection. And if it's rejected, then you need another valve from another cadaver or a pig, something like that. Right? If you get a valve from a cadaver, there's always a chance that you might get infectious disease, like different forms of hepatitis or AIDS or other kinds of things. And nobody volunteers for that. Right? If it's a prosthetic valve, they have a tendency to form clots. They won't be rejected, but they have a tendency to form clots. So you have to be on anticoagulation therapy pretty much for the rest of your life, like heparin or coumarin, coumadin. And so you have to choose what route you want to go. And maybe a physician could help you make that choice. Okay, so yeah, these valves are hugely important. And that was sort of a pun when I said hugely of who asked the question. Okay. Any other questions with regard to the heart? No? Okay, well, let's get started a little bit on some blood vessels to give you a little bit of an orientation. All right, so where are the blood blood vessel notes? Ah, here we are right here. Okay, some of this we know already. And before I put that away, let's go back to this slide right here. So here's a slide you're familiar with, right? Here's a cardiac slide. Not only does it have the heart, all four chambers, right, the two sides, it shows you circulation, the two major circulations coming from opposite sides of the heart. But here is that general scheme of a circulatory pattern. Blood moves away from the heart via an artery. Then it goes into a capillary network. The capillary network there is for what's happening in a capillary network. Important word, exchange. And then blood returns to the heart via a vein. So those are the three major types of blood vessels. So let's start to look at some of these major types of blood vessels that I have on this word slide right here. Okay. Where is it? Is it here? Yes. Okay, sorry, I don't know why it's opening up on the wrong projector. All right, so here we have that same pattern. We have blood moving away from the heart, right? So if you want to draw like a little heart right here, you can. So the heart is up over superior to where this illustration is. So blood is moving away from the heart into this blood vessel. So it's moving away from the heart. This blood vessel has to be an artery, right? Blood then flows through a capillary network where exchange takes place. Things move from high concentration to low concentration, down a diffusion gradient or concentration gradient, and then blood flows from a capillary into this blood vessel that returns it to the heart, and that is a vein, right? Okay, well, we want to know something about these arteries and veins and capillaries by the layers that make them up. And layers are really important because that's how we understand disease processes. This is how we diagnose disease processes. And by knowing what layers are involved, then we can come up with treatments, right, for kind of disease processes. And we don't want to have any disease in our body. So good treatment is really important. All right, so look at the thickness of an artery, wall thickness. Look at the thickness of a vein. And look at the thickness of a capillary. Which one is the thinnest? Is it really obvious which one has the thinnest wall? Here is an artery. Here is a vein, here is a capillary. Which one is thinnest? Yeah, it should jump right out at you. It's a capillary. And because
The capillary wall is so thin that allows for movement of material across the wall, from blood into tissue spaces or tissue spaces into the blood. The walls of arteries and veins are way too thick, right, and impermeable to compounds. Anything that's in a vein is stuck in a vein until it gets to a capillary. Anything that's in an artery is stuck in an artery until that blood gets to a capillary, right, because capillaries are very thin. Let's look at a capillary first. Right? So here is a layer of tissue, right, that's making the wall of the capillary, and it's really an epithelium. Right? An epithelium makes a surface, covers a surface, right, or lines a cavity. So here is a cavity, or you can think of it as a surface, inside surface of a blood vessel. Right? That's an epithelium, but because it's in a blood vessel, we don't call it an epithelium, we call it an endothelium, because it's lining the inside of something, an endothelium. And we would name an endothelium just like we would a classic epithelium. How are the ways that we would name an epithelium? What are the two main characteristics that we have to remember about an epithelium? Shape and layers. Okay? So let's take a look. What are the layers? How many layers do you see from the basement membrane to this apical surface? How many cells do you see right here? I see one. So what kind of epithelium is that by layers? And your choices are simple or stratified? It's simple, right? So here is a simple epithelium. Now, what is, and the second way that we characterize epithelium is by the shape of the cells. And what is the shape of these cells right here? Your choices are squamous, cuboidal, columnar. And they are, look how thin they are. They look like a pancake. Right? So these are squamous cells. So this epithelium, which we call an endothelium, is a simple squamous epithelium. And simple squamous epithelium is specialized for exchange, right? Because it's really thin. So that's what makes up a capillary, along with this little basement membrane right here, very thin structure. So it allows for movement from the blood into tissue spaces and also vice versa. The lining of an artery and a vein is also an endothelium. It's just a simple squamous epithelium. And just like the endocardium in the heart, all of these endothelia are smooth and slippery. They don't have any jagged edges in them. That's important because otherwise blood clots will be generated. Don't want any blood clots. All right, so what are some of the main layers in an artery and a vein? Capillary, there's only this one. All right, there are three main layers in arteries and veins. There's a tunica intima, which is the innermost layer. Endothelium is a part of it. The tunica media is, like it says, in the middle. And the tunica externa is the outermost layer. These are the three layers. Both arteries and veins have them, but a little bit different configuration. Remember, there's high pressure in an artery, low pressure in a vein. That makes sure that blood flows from an artery to a vein. It just goes down a pressure gradient. So arteries have to be a lot stronger and thicker, more muscle, more connective tissue, so that that high pressure doesn't blow them up, cause an aneurysm, right, or a break in a blood vessel, dissection of a blood vessel. All right, so the outermost layer, tunica externa, has collagen fibers. And remember, collagen fibers are what kind of fibers in terms of strength? Weakest or strongest? Collagen are the strongest, right? So collagen makes tendons, ligaments, things like that. It also makes up the tunica externa. Collagen also makes up what? The reticular layer of the dermis. Very strong layers, right? Tunica externa, very strong layer. And it's fairly thick. Okay, the next layer, tunica media, has a couple other things. Okay, here is an elastic layer, right, with elastic fibers. Different than collagen. They're not strong, but what's really nice about an elastic fiber? It can stretch, and then when that pressure or tension is released, it goes back to its original shape. So some of these arteries are very stretchy. They can expand and then they can collapse back down to their normal size. So when the heart contracts and pushes a whole bunch of blood into an artery, some arteries can expand and that's normal. Okay? And then when the heart relaxes, then that blood vessel, those elastic fibers, right, squish
the artery back down to its normal size, help pushing blood around. The other thing in the tunica media is some smooth muscle, right? And even some more elastic fibers, right? Smooth muscle means that this artery can constrict or dilate. And it also can fight against that force of pressure that's trying to blow up this blood vessel to make it a really large diameter. So this smooth muscle just maintains a proper diameter of an artery. And I see this as a pretty thick layer because there's high pressure inside of an artery. All right, that takes us to the next layer, the tunica intima. Right, the deepest part is the endothelium. Then there's an endothelial layer, which is the basement membrane, and then even some more elastic tissue. All right, so this basement membrane here, this subendothelial layer, just make sure that the endothelium is glued to the elastic membrane, which then is glued to the smooth muscle, right, which then is glued together with the tunica externa, all these collagen fibers. When I look inside an artery, do you see, I see the endothelium, right, that nice simple squamous epithelium. Do you see any structures in the center of this tube? Remember, the center of this tube is called the lumen. Do you see anything in the lumen? Do you see any other structures on the inside of this blood vessel? Okay, sort of a trick question. Okay, and you're not missing anything. There's really nothing there. Right, the wall of the endothelium is smooth and continuous and straight, right, and there's really nothing inside an artery. Let's look at a vein. Okay, now the vein has some wiggles on it. The artery, I see nice concentricity right here, which means that it's always going to be circular. It doesn't collapse. But a vein, see this little wiggle right here, means that it can collapse. It's not as strong as an artery. Why is it not as strong? Well, it still has collagen fibers on the outside, but this layer typically is not as thick as on an artery. That's not shown very well on this slide, but typically it's not as thick. Okay, there is a layer that's missing. There are no elastic fibers in a vein. So veins can't expand like an artery can. And look at the smooth muscle. All right, what is the thickness of smooth muscle in a vein compared to an artery? Is it the same thickness or is it thinner? It's definitely thinner. It's thinner because there's not as much pressure inside of a vein compared to an artery. So it doesn't need as much muscle. Right? It does have the endothelium, right, and a nice subendothelial layer, but it doesn't contain any elastic membranes or elastic layers in a vein. Right, but it does have that nice simple squamous endothelium. And if you look inside the lumen of a vein, do you see any structures? Remember, you told me for an artery there were no structures. What about if we look in the lumen of a vein? Do you see any structures in a vein? Now, this is a really good question. Okay, not a trick question, because there is something. And what do we see? We see a valve right here. So in veins, blood can, if it's a nice healthy vein, blood can only flow in one direction. And what direction is that? What did I tell you to draw in on the top of this slide over here? A heart. So blood in a vein can only flow back to the heart because veins have valves in them. Arteries don't have valves. Capillaries don't have valves, but they have some special muscles in them that we'll look at in just a little bit. Okay. And these valves are made out of endothelium, just like the valves in the heart are made out of the endocardium. They're smooth and slippery, and they make sure blood flows back only to the heart, not back down to where blood came from. Right? So if blood flows back down to where it came from, you'd have pooling of blood in your extremities. And can anybody remember what happens to blood when it stops flowing? It forms a clot. Okay? And so when these valves are damaged, maybe somebody's valve dilated too much, this vessel here gets too big in diameter, then these leaflets of the valves can't touch each other, so they can't close. They just flop back and forth with a hole between them. And then blood can pool in this area, generate a clot. We call that what? Venous thrombosis. That can happen with deep veins. That's called deep venous thrombosis. That's a very serious condition. Okay. Sometimes people have superficial veins where that happens too, and we call that varicose veins. Typically not as dangerous, but it can be. And if it's really bad, people then might elect to have some of those veins removed from their body, all right? Or wear special kinds of boots or stockings or something to compress those veins, right? So if a vein dilates too much, the valves don't work, and then you can have pooling of blood in your extremities. Not a good thing, because what should it do? It should flow back to your heart. All right, so those are the layers of the heart. Okay, types of blood vessels. You know a lot about types of blood vessels, right? You got arteries, capillaries, and veins. But you also have something in between. All right, so here is an artery. Here is a tiny artery. And these can be microscopic. A small artery is called an arteriole. All right, here is an arteriole right here. And then here we have a capillary. These capillary networks will then rejoin. We call that anastomose, when smaller things join together to make something bigger. So this capillary network anastomoses to form a very small vein. A very small vein is called a venule. And then venules join together to form a bigger vein, and that's what we call a vein. Okay? So you got arteries, arterioles, capillaries, venules, and veins, and they all have a little bit different function. Okay, arteries. Always take blood away from the heart. And remember, blood in an artery can be oxygenated or deoxygenated. And you should be able to give me an example of each. Give me the name of an artery that has relatively high oxygen. What's the name of an artery that has high oxygen? The aorta. What artery has relatively low oxygen? The pulmonary artery or pulmonary trunk. Right? So on all those pictures of the heart, the pulmonary trunk, pulmonary arteries were colored blue, and the aorta was always colored red. And if you look at the arrows for both those vessels were pointing away from the heart, right? So color doesn't determine, or the state of oxygen does not determine whether something's an artery or a vein, just the direction of blood flow. Okay. Well, I'm going to start up next time, talk about some other things about arteries. And don't be late to the next class, because here's something really important. And that how blood flow is related to the diameter of a blood vessel. Okay, that's going to be really important. Blood flow to different parts of your body is hugely important. Remember, blood doesn't get to the brain. What happens? You die. All right, so diameter of a blood vessel is crucial to know how blood flow is regulated in your body. And that's where we're going to start next time. The sign-in sheet is going around. And I'll see you all upstairs. All right, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet.